my first time to the Institute, I'm a little, as I was expressing, I'm not sure which end of the hockey stick I point with. Maybe I'll try the blade first and see how it works. So why do I even care about boosted bosons at all? Probably many people in the audience already know why, but I'll tell you anyway. It's awfully nasty to have to deal with these hadronic final states, because we happen to smash together hadrons, and they really like to interact. So the goal is to be able to filter out a hadronic final state you're actually interested in this case, something like a Higgs or a W or Z boson. Those really like to decay into hadrons. We'd like to be able to find as many of them as possible. But how can I tell those apart from just other hadronic stuff that I get for free all the time? Actually, I wish I didn't get it. In the high PT regime, these two really end up looking almost exactly the same to first order. You see a big spray of junk at some high PT. So one thing you can do, of course, is you can say, well, okay, but those can occasionally give me leptons. I can find all the ones that give me leptons. That's fairly easy. But the key word is occasionally. They like to give you hadrons a lot more, and we'd like to take advantage of that. And this high PT regime is very common in all of our models, especially now that the LHC has told us everything should be fairly heavy, because I make a heavy new thing and it decays. If it gives me a W or a Z or a Higgs, it's probably boosted because it had to be so heavy.
Well, the standard of statistics, you have to qualify it a little bit, right? Because, look, the Z is 6% to leptons. You're never going to beat that with any kind of hadronic stuff. But if you have two Zs, then you might be able to talk about, well, I don't want to require both of them to be leptonic. I want to be one of them to be boosted hadronic and the other leptonic, and things like that.
Yeah,
but ultimately,
it's a question of how much I need cleanliness versus statistics, which one of these I should choose.
Right.
So it depends on.
6% is still.
Well, the W is more than that.
Right, W is 20%, right? So you're not losing that much on going to leptonic. Right?
Well, we'll see.
Okay. For the Higgs, I totally buy your argument, but for W and Z, I think it's questionable.
Just an act.
So, some examples of these models where I'm going to naturally be getting boosted bosons. Just a very incomplete list. And the dot, dot, dot contains an arbitrarily large number of other things. You know, there could be strong dynamics in composite Higgs models. These generically give me new resonances of weak bosons. They're going to be produced. They're high mass because we haven't seen them yet. So I'm going to get boosted bosons. There, I may get a pair of bosons, and I might do best by saying exactly as Itai has said, maybe one of these should be leptonic, and then I don't want to lose the fraction again on the second one. Suzy decay chains can often have these Ws, Zs, or Higgses somewhere in the decay chain, usually fairly late down at the Eno stage. And we're very interested, now that we have a Higgs, of making sure that it's actually the Higgs. And actually, I think it was Atlas just recently has published a result looking at WW scatterings in VBF. And they've done this using leptonic decays at the moment, trying to verify that these scatterings are actually unitarized the way they're supposed to be. Currently, all they have is 3-sigma evidence that these scatterings can happen in VBF. But as we go up in luminosity and statistics, we're going to get much further along in that front. It could be TT bar resonances from any number of things. So now that's not giving me just a boosted boson, it gives me a boosted top. So you need to be slightly more sophisticated about tagging things that decay to 3 prongs instead of 2. So a small sampling of the applications that already exist. We have TT bar resonances in the lepton plus jets final state. This actually was requiring a boosted W as one of its criteria. Here's another. And this is actually my personal favorite for totally unrelated reasons. As some of you, I'm sure, know, a search for dark matter in events where I want a hadronically decaying W or Z, and the way I tell that it's a W or Z is using exactly a tagging technique. So here's one plot from there. And this is the first and actually best tag that exists. You say, okay, how heavy is that jet? The answer in QCD is almost whatever you want. You can see the QCD background is pretty flat here. There's a huge peak over at low masses. But out here in the tail, it's pretty flat, and it has a very long tail. But W's and Z's give me this very nice peak, because the resonance structure at the electroweak stage fixes an invariant mass, and I can't borrow that much from behind it without pushing myself off the resonance.
Wait, but you're saying that looking for the bound you can place at the cross section from hadronic Z is stronger than the bound you can place on the same cross section from letting the Z go to the tongue?
Well, this is a search for hadronic W and Z.
No,
the key point actually comparing to Z is that I do much better for W because W cross sections are so much bigger.
I understand, but I'm saying there is a one-to-one comparison that you cannot avoid. If the Z goes hadronically, it also goes leptonically. So the same process that generated that will also generate the Z to lepton plus missing energy.
Yes.
My guess would be that bound would be much stronger than this bound.
Well, you might also say, well, the W can also go leptonically. I'll get an electron or a muon. And I'll get very large transverse mass. It won't look anything like a W. I can place a bound based on that. And that's got a much bigger branching fraction than the Z. So you might say, okay, that sounds pretty promising. Why are we bothering with this?
Yes, why are we bothering with
this? And this is actually why. Because CMS has gone and done that search in the monolepton channel. And they have a bound here. Now this bound should be compared to this, because C is minus 1, means that I couple with isospin. So the coupling to up and down quarks has a relative minus sign. That should be compared to this D5 line here, which is about a factor of 2 higher from the hadronic search than from the leptonic search from CMS. That factor of 2 is actually raised to the 4th power in a cross-section. So this hadronic boosted boson search is actually much stronger than the leptonic W search. So they, first of all, they demand that it fall within an appropriate mass window, and they also have a mass drop cut that I'll describe in some detail in a moment.
I don't think I understand your point.
Well, these are looking for identical final states, W plus missing energy. This one uses a leptonic decay. This one uses a hadronic decay. And this one is stronger by a factor of 2^4 in cross-section than that.
Awesome. That's a question depending on the coupling and all those sort of things.
But this is the coupling on the y-axis here. This is the...
Is it exactly the same model?
Yes.
Okay. And lambda means the same.
Lambda and m star are this notational difference. That's right.
I guess I'm still confused about the first question I asked you. Is that if I take a Z, mono Z, my bet would be mono Z hadronic will always fail against mono Z lepton.
I have not made that comparison 1-to-1. But mono Z comes also with mono W. And in this model where I have this coupling choice.
Not necessarily. I can put up a model where it doesn't.
Yes, if I had an operator that coupled specifically to Z's.
Okay.
These are both operators that just couple to quarks, and I have an ISR weak boson.
So is what's going on just that because you only have one lepton and the W is also giving a missing energy when it gets leptonically, that partially cancels the missing energy from the dark matter, and so your cut efficiencies are lower? Or
I do not believe so. I think that actually you're much better at throwing away backgrounds here than you think you would be. No.
So
the hadronic backgrounds are actually much smaller than we naively expect because these tagging algorithms are quite good. So this is actually a case that I think is particularly nice because it's not any of the cases I was telling you about before. It's not some place where, oh, of course, there will be boosted bosons. My model predicts it.
Mono Z, and just don't use one of the leptons.
Yes, you could do this.
And if what you're saying is right, is that the issue is really the tagging efficiency, the tagging for those algorithms is very good, then you should find out with the mono Z.
Yes, I can test on the mono Z. These models that are best bounded here actually produce 90% W's and 10% Z's only. So there are certainly some pictures where at least it's better because W's are your dominant signal. The thing I like about this isn't a model that's decaying and always giving me a boosted W, though. It's just sometimes your W is boosted, and just taking advantage of the sometimes, you get a huge improvement in your reach. So let's look at these events a little more closely and see what exactly are we trying to take apart. So my W decays into two jets. When my W is going fairly slowly, I can see two jets. Now you might say, OK, well, that's fine. I need two jets that have an invariant mass of the W boson mass. This, it turns out, is a giant disaster, because you always have enough jets that you can always find a pair that make a W boson to first order. You do much better when your W gets going fast and makes one jet that happens to look like a W inside one jet.
Is that really just because you're putting a hard PTU cut on the W anyway, so you're already getting a pretty substantial boosted fraction? Because I mean, you imagine that if I just ask for two jets that reconstruct a W versus, you know, looking at a single QCD jet that has jet substructure looking at W. I guess I'm just trying to figure out if what you're saying is true absolutely, or just with the cuts you're imposing.
Well, this is actually the only way in which I make that statement is one that's purely anecdotal. I was trying at one point to go about doing these WW scattering measurements a long time ago back in my graduate student days. And I said, well, it'd be awfully nice if I could reconstruct the whole event. What happens if I say, OK, I have two forward jets, and I ask for two Ws, and only one of them is leptonic, so that I can now reconstruct the full thing? And the answer is that in both my signal and my background, effectively every single event had a W in it, even though it doesn't have a W in it. There's just too much QCD that's vaguely soft-ish, that's going at different angles. It's easy to make up a fake W boson. Whereas it's much more unlikely for me to have one QCD jet that happens to have just the right substructure. So if I zoom in on this jet, here it is in the lab frame. I've got a bunch of stuff.
I would say basically that when you're looking for something good, the boost removes the combinatorial ambiguity that you
exactly have. Right. Yes. The boost makes it so I don't have to worry about the wide angle things that happen to reconstruct the W. Because I know I'm expecting a small angle. So my jet in the lab frame always looks like this. It's just a pile of stuff. And if I move to the center of mass frame, if I had a W that made a jet, it should look like this. Two back-to-back jets. This is a top, or any three-jet resonance, but the one we know best is a top. And this is what a QCD jet should look like. It should just be sort of stochastic random radiation. So I want to tell those apart. Apart from taking the jet mass and saying, OK, I want it to be the boson mass. And of course, you need a relatively wide window to be able to do that with any reasonability, because there's all these uncertainties in measuring, did I miss some neutrinos from this jet? Who knows? The jet energy scale is not a perfect one-to-one correspondence. If that were, then we wouldn't hate jets so much. So the window widths that you tend to use are about 30 GeV wide, so plus or minus 15 GeV-ish. And I say this based purely on the fact that that's what the experimentalists do, and I trust them to do something sensible. The secondary approach, after you've applied a mass cut, you say, OK, well, not only do I want the jet to have the right mass, I want it to look a lot less like this than like this. So one approach you could take is, well, OK, I want actually to be able to reconstruct two prongs and count how many jets I think are inside this jet. This is like n-jettiness type approaches. The one the experimentalists have used so far is actually based on a mass drop. So they take their JED algorithm, they have this thing they think might be a W, it has the right mass. They undo the last step of the JED algorithm. Now they have two objects. They say, okay, before I undid that, I had a mass for the total object. Now I want to know the mass of each of the remaining objects. So for a W boson where it's going to be two massless quarks up to the QCD virtuality, I should get a much smaller mass for each of the two prongs of the W than I did for the whole W. That makes perfect sense. And that's exactly what they require. If the mass drops significantly, meaning usually to around something like a quarter of the previous mass for the heavier of the two prongs, then you say, okay, that had a big mass drop in it. I really do think that's a W. If it doesn't, then you say, okay, well, which one's heavier? You have one heavy jet and one light jet left. You say, well, maybe just this heavy jet was the W, and this was a little radiation that I combined later, and you repeat it on the heavy jet. You say, okay, was there a big mass drop this time? And you keep playing this game until you run out of unclusterings to do.
Sometimes
I have that coming right up.
Okay.
So this finds jets that have some well-separated subprongs that aren't particularly heavy themselves, and it's the separation between them that's giving the whole jet its mass. So here is the performance of these algorithms from a CMS search. This was a study for W jet resonances, so this is an excited quark model they have. But it could just as well be a T prime that's giving me WB, and I just don't happen to use the B tag. So this is their tagging efficiency for hadronic disease. Actually, so it's not WJET, it's VJET they searched for. For Q star goes to WQ. These are the efficiencies they expect, and this is the efficiency they get for their QCD simulations. You know, there's a big difference between the simulations. There usually is. These are the kinds of things that it's hard to know what the right answer is without actually looking at data, because it's far out in the tails of these choices about hadronization models and everything else. In this case, it seems the data kind of prefers Herwig, but I don't know that there's any sensible way in which to parameterize this. Out here, I'm getting to the point where resolution effects are important. They're only using calorimetry resolution, so they only use towers in the algorithm, I believe. So what's happening is I'm getting out to the point where my PT is high enough that I have a significant chance for things to land in the same bin, in the same tower. That happens a little bit later for Zs because they're heavier, so you get a little more separation. I'm not certain exactly how many points there are between here and here either on this plot. So I want to ask a slightly different question. I want to say, okay, give me a jet. What do I see? This is the standard plot for how we see these things. It's some Lego plot. We get a huge, each Kalo tower is actually a tower. It has a height. That's the amount of energy that was deposited. But I think actually that looking at this way has blinded us to one possibility. And that's the possibility that we could picture this instead of this way, we could look at it like this. Wait, no, I lied. It's not quite like that. It's a little bit different. It's more like this. So if each tower I treat as a pixel, what I have is a grayscale image where brightness is energy. I don't pretend to understand that.
We use the LHC to find out which is the true
religion. Yeah, that's right.
If these, yeah, if you should write this up, you'll get Templeton money immediately. But so if I take an image like this, now I have all kinds of other tools available. Because our culture really likes pictures. We've thought lots and lots about the best way to think about pictures, the best way to compress them, the best way to transmit them, everything else. One of the tools that gets used on these things is wavelets. So wavelets are sort of a localized Fourier transform. It's the best way to think about them, really. They have a position, but they also have a frequency. You know, it kind of embodies the uncertainty principle, really. You say, how well can I know the frequency? Well, it depends on how wide of a position I'm willing to look in. They're particularly good at edge detection. They've been...
Right, the idea is that you can look for a dominant frequency in a particular time.
Well, or in a particular position, depending on your frequency or wavelength. Yeah.
No, but there's,
yeah, but C is one. C is one, so these are the same.
Oh, the H bar is what matters. There's no H bar. H bar is not, there's no H bar here.
That's true. These have been used, for instance, to be certain about how bubbly the bubbles are. Do they really have edges, or are they just a smear at the end? They really have edges. They're also used as a pre-tag for point sources to be further investigated in the Fermi collaboration. They've been used for image compression. They use this to wash out features smaller than some scale, which are usually noise. You can wash out noise at the 1 pixel level by saying, OK, I just want to look at the features that are bigger than 1 pixel. Maybe they're 2x2. And they're actually part of this compression standard that we've all been using for a while now. And conveniently enough, people have made a totally ridiculous number of different types of wavelets. We have all of these different ugly types of wavelets. This one here, for instance, really spiky and weird looking, that's excellent at measuring fourth derivatives. Why you want to measure the fourth derivative of something, I don't know, but that's what it does. This one over here, called the Haar wavelet, is just 1 pixel up, 1 pixel down. And that's the simplest thing to use on fundamentally pixelated data. So if I take that thing and then I say, wait a minute, you drew a one-dimensional wavelet. How do I generalize that? Well, I have to take something called the father wavelet, which is both pixels up, as well as the mother wavelet, one up and one down. And I multiply them by each other in both dimensions. So this here is a father wavelet squared, also called the scaling function. The father by the mother in two different directions, and the mother wavelet squared. And those are all linearly independent, as you can trivially observe. And each of these things gets applied to the image, and I see what comes out of it. This is going to be very good at finding vertical edges, this at horizontal edges, this is good at things that are between the two. This often is called the diagonal transform. So if I take my jet and I run this on it, here's my jet. I do a wavelet transform, and I can pick out all kinds of features. So here, like I said, this one's the one that's very good at finding vertical edges. So you could see this stripe up the center of the tower and this here. The windows show up fairly well. This one's good at finding horizontal edges, of which there are far fewer. But the top of the tower shows up fairly nicely. And over here, I get anything that's in between. And you can actually see, I took this, I ran the wavelet algorithm once. You would have said, OK, this big box should be the father wavelet times the image. But the natural thing to do is to say, OK, but that's an image, an ordinary image, and I can run the wavelet transform on it as well. And you can cascade this all the way up into the corner until you actually have 1 pixel that's the only father wavelet pixel. That's just the average brightness of the whole image. And this gives me all of the information that was contained in the original image is contained here, just in a different basis. So we have a problem, though, because we aren't interested in the whole picture. If I think back about the Lego plot I had a while ago, really, I want to know what's going on close to that tall Calla tower. And if I average over the whole calorimeter, I'm throwing away the whole use of wavelet-ness having a position. I may as well just do a Fourier transform on the whole calorimeter. So using a standard jet algorithm, you could say, okay, where's the jet? Somebody will tell me, well, the jet has a momentum that points in this direction. So, okay, that points at a cell in the calorimeter, and I'm interested in things that contain that cell. That's the simple requirement I want to place to have a region of interest. So, in particular, I'm going to look at just the father wavelets that include that cell of interest, and I want to shift that around to include all the possible father wavelets that would include that cell and keep the highest energy that I managed to enclose. There's another issue as well, which is exactly the issue we were talking about. Why does this drop off at higher masses? Or the issue of, I'd really like to have one algorithm for all W's and not a different one for each momentum. So what I want, what I'd really like to do maybe is to use the calorimeter cell size for my pixel size. Life would be so good, I would actually have a perfect correspondence grayscale image in my calorimeter onto this wavelet transform. But unfortunately, that gives me a different characteristic size of a W boson for a different PT. And because the natural way to apply these wavelets is it's sizes of 2 to the n on a side, it becomes hard to differentiate between various things when I get sizes that aren't a convenient number, like, say, 10 cells apart. There's much more angular information available in an event than just the HCAL. ECAL has a resolution about 10 times better, and the tracker is much, much better than that. We have all these fancy particle flow algorithms we use to normalize our jets and learn what's going on better. So I want to zoom the cell size to keep the W boson separations, the two prongs, I want them always to be about the same size if I were to guess based on the PT of the jet I measure. That way I can write one algorithm and hopefully collect a lot of W's.
Sorry, going back to the previous slide, you were saying you want to keep father wavelets and include the cell of interest, and I do not understand what that means.
I will have a picture of that in a second.
Thank you.
So the father wavelet was the one that's averaging, rather than subtracting
but
one side against the other.
It's averaging over some restricted area?
Yes, the restriction being it must include the cell that is the center, that is the jet momentum direction. So here we are.
Okay.
This is a typical QCD jet in some pseudo-calorimeter that has been scaled in the way I described. This black dot here, so now I see the disadvantage of pointing with the hockey stick blade. It's much less precise. There, that is the jet axis as defined by the jet algorithm. At the center of that cell is where the jet supposedly is. After having run a jet algorithm, it has a momentum. It points to the center of that cell. And what I want to require is that each of these father wavelets I end up choosing include that cell. So at a size that's 2 by 2, I'm going to take this box, and I could shift it down one, or to the right one, or both, and that would still be satisfied. There are 4 possibilities. But I keep the one that has the most energy enclosed. And at the size 4 by 4, now I can pick any of the cells enclosed to be that point, so there's 16 possibilities, right? I keep the one that encloses the most energy. And I scale this to all sizes, well, all sizes I'm interested in, up to 16 by 16. Because of the jet algorithm that got used, I'm going to enclose everything in 32 by 32 for sure anyway. It's just a function of what R was on the jet algorithm. So that's not a very meaningful number. But I can plot this as a curve. My wavelet coefficient, this is normalized to the total jet energy, versus the window size. And this is what a QCD jet looks like. I have just, there's a jet axis, stuff is sprayed out kind of randomly about it. If I look at a W boson instead, now I have a jet axis, and I choose the wavelets that include the most energy possible each time. This W boson actually looks as though it was probably transversely polarized, if I were to guess. It's kind of cute. You can look at these pictures and make these guesses. Transverse polarizations like to throw one particle forward and one back. So one of these prongs should be harder than the other. And that's, in fact, what we see. This one has a lot more energy deposited than this. But if I, again, keep all of these coefficients, I get this very different looking plot of the wavelet coefficients. So I'm going from this, which is pretty flat, pretty smooth, to something that has some very serious features, some kinks in it, that show up when I include a new wave, a new prong. And so it's those kinks I want to pick up. Those are actually parameterized in this W sub J variable, which is simply a second derivative on a piecewise plot, on a discrete number. So looking at those two events, you would have never questioned, okay, that one looks like a jet, that one looks like a W, what's the problem? The problem is you want to be able to do this over tens of thousands of events very fast. So I need something that's automatizable, is that the word? I don't even know. That I can automate, much more simple construction. So, you know, the collaborations are big, but the data sets are way bigger. They can't actually look at the pictures and say, okay, I know what that one is, I don't know what that one is, etc. These power curves we produce, the wavelet coefficient versus size curves, are much easier to write an analysis for, and it's this discrete second derivative that we're interested in. And it's
what's the computational
speed?
Yeah, how does it scale
with the number of events? Linearly, because it's
no, written. Of course, linearly the number of events. But how many computations do you do to do, like, let's say, a grid of 30 up to 32?
Up to 32.
Because you need to, it's 4 for the smallest ones, and
4, and then 16,
and then
etc.
That grows pretty fast.
It grows fairly fast, but luckily we stop at 16 by 16. So it's still a somewhat small number. We're running this in a horrendously slow framework that I won't name just to avoid making any software companies angry. Presumably when we code it as simpler templates analyses and we do this by hand to make it fast, it will be much faster. Even still, we're running this on pretty large data sets of Monte Carlo and doing it in finite time. So it's these second derivatives, and you note I only have 2, because, as I said, 32 is not a very meaningful point. So I could have a second derivative here or here. I don't have enough information for anything else that's a second derivative.
So, question. So if I understand correctly, the reason why the W looks different is because the jet axis is somewhat displaced, say, from the subject axes, and so you start off without really having much energy.
That's certainly why I get this feature here.
Yeah. So,
but a flattening and a re-steepening mm-hmm. up here, this is also weird.
Right. And that's what I'm wondering is that. So, for the mass drop tag, you're picking out QCD jets that also have some per one wide angle splitting that's giving you most of the mass. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm just wondering whether for the events that would be mistagged by the mass drop tag, or do they look different in this?
An excellent question. It will come. So I'm going to cut on this variable. Okay, I'm ready. I'm going to now do my analysis. How efficient can I be with this compared to the mass drop tagger, say? Here it is. This is just getting the mass right. And this result in green is the result if you use this wavelet tagger. And this result in blue is what is the result you get if you use this mass drop cut. Okay, not very exciting. The green curve is always worse than the blue. So the next question that then pops into mind is, why am I here giving you a talk in the first place? Who cares about this? It doesn't work. Well, as we all know, when you run some analysis, you get to apply more than one cut. So this is actually an extraordinarily simple analysis. Well, I should say, what, 8 extraordinarily simple analyses. There are 8 different signal regions from this paper. They've applied just a few cuts to each, 8 jets that are at least 50 GeV, say. And then they consider how many B jets there are. They have some requirement on the significance of the missing energy, but decidedly more than just one type of cut. So that's what I want to do. I want to say, OK, well, here's a new cut. How degenerate was it with the previous cut? How much am I doing better or different at all from that mass drop cut? So this is now the space that I'm interested in. One of these is W's and the other is jets. And I have the cut parameter that I would apply to that W, requiring that it be higher than some value, and the mass drop cut parameter, the fraction to which the mass has to be reduced after a splitting in the mass drop cut algorithm. So which is jets and which is W's? The shading, that's why it's hard, actually. The shading is a survival rate. I had a number of events that existed on a log scale. It's log of survival rate. So actually, once you know what the z-axis is, it gets easier to tell which is which, right? This one over here must be jets, because there's a huge fraction that are already lost when I apply the loosest possible cuts. If that was my signal instead and this was the background, I'd be really screwed. But you can see this has more of a shoulder-like feature. Actually, you can't really with this projector, can you? I'm sorry about that. This has more of a square-type feature than this does, which is much more angled this way. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply both cuts, require that my event live up in this corner, above and to the right of some point, and say, OK, how well can I do now? So these are the cuts. This is the same parameter space. Actually, it's unfortunately flipped x and y, because that's the plot that my collaborator who has the code made. So this is my wavelet cut, and this is the mass drop cut. And the circles are the points where, given a fixed mass drop cut, I choose the wavelet cut on this axis to maximize my signal significance. I actually can do this without recourse to what the cross sections are, because it's still going to scale like the signal acceptance over the square root of the background acceptance. And this is pretty flat, but it isn't down at zero. So this cut is providing me something. So we were too lazy to actually model this. We just said, OK, well, we're just going to take a flat cut. It's a small deviation from what's ideal, and it doesn't require you to recompute what's ideal every single time you try to run an analysis, because then you end up using your signal region as calibration. You don't have anything left to analyze. One of these is trying to fit this as a linear curve with a slope, and the other is just a flat line.
So this is a cut you're putting on your wavelet after you put a mass drop cut that's equal to the one on the x-axis?
And I could place them in either order, it wouldn't matter. But yes, I'm requiring both of these algorithms to say, I think that's a W. You might instead say, well, maybe I could do better. I could improve my signal acceptance, surely, by saying if either of them says that's a W, then I'm good. But it turns out that you profit more by rejecting that little bit more background that doesn't have the same behavior in the two variables. So if I combine these two, and now I'm looking at a purity, I can go from just the jet mass and mass drop results up by another reasonable amount. It's not fantastic. It's not something to jump up and down about, but it's useful. this purity is something I would imagine using for high precision measurement. Maybe I wanted to look at a W bosons in this situation, and I want to be sure I have W's for what I'm looking at. I want to measure some property of them. It's not I'm trying to discover whether W's are there or not. If I'm trying to discover whether there are boosted W's or not, then I need this curve. This is a sensitivity. This is now signal acceptance over the background acceptance, square root. And here I have a slight improvement in my sensitivity as well, as I must have had to have an improvement in my purity. This is where I get just requiring that I get the right jet mass. So neither of these algorithms is providing me a huge boost, but we need every ounce we can get out of the hadronic final states at the LHC.
Is there a narrow
on this plot?
What's the uncertainty? I mean, those lines are more.
So one, I can tell you about two types of uncertainty, right? There's always two. One is statistics.
Yes.
There is no statistical error. The statistical error is much thinner than these lines.
Yes.
So the systematics. How much of a systematic do I assign to the fact that I used Pythia to model QCD? An arbitrarily large systematic. I don't know what to do about that. Any showering algorithm is going to give me something I just really don't believe, ultimately. And the sensible thing to think is I should be able to calibrate this on data in one case, and then I will believe it up to the statistics from data. I will have a curve, and I will know what is the best cuts to apply. And then I can use this in a future analysis. It's the only sensible way to use any of these substructure things. N-jettiness has some better behavior under analytic QCD, but once I apply it to Pythia, I again don't believe what it's doing.
So you don't really know if this one will be better than what they already do?
I have no way to test that without access to the data. But I do know that using the QCD samples for, say, the top taggers has done mysteriously well at predicting how well they'll do. So there is some sense in which Pythia is modeling something right about nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I have access to, so that's what I can test on.
Did you try to model Pileup?
You mean in-time Pileup, presumably? I cannot model that any better than what I could do again with Pythia by saying, oh, there's multiple events. But I don't have a model that I believe of how well the detectors do at vertex detection either. I could stack up a pile of events. Absolutely, I can do that. But if there are 20 of them, probably they can differentiate every vertex. And they can do a decent job of the background subtraction. There's this, you know, I use for my usual pileup subtraction for underlying events, say, where I don't see any jets. They tell me that the best thing to do is to take your jet area and assume there is some fixed amount of energy per unit area that lands in a jet that isn't due to the actual jet I'm interested in. I can do that. It will give me a different normalization of my grayscale image. But that won't matter very much.
There's also going to be fluctuations at each size.
I'll get some Poisson fluctuation in how much energy I've gotten in each place, yes.
So there's some grooming that's part of the mass drop tagger, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is the wavelet cut that you're putting after grooming?
The wavelet cut is after grooming, but it's independent of the jet algorithm, which I think is where the main complementarity is coming from. This does not depend on what jet algorithm you've chosen. It just depends on where the jet is pointing.
Yeah, but the radiation you're using for your input is the grooming.
Yes.
Now, relatedly, so your wavelets look a bit like square cone jets.
They do. So you might say, okay, there's this variable. What do they call it? I forget. The jet profile, maybe? Which is almost the same thing as not so much square, but circular, cone jets. And I say, I had a jet, its radius was r. How much of it is inside a radius of smaller r? This is certainly similar to that, But one of the great advantages I think that we have compared to an analysis based on that is this ability to shift the center of our cone jet back and forth. It's
a different wavelength pattern. Right, you have a wavelength pattern, which is a Haar measure. You can put the.
I could use a ring instead.
A toral measure. Which
yes, if I use a toral measure and I require that it is centered exactly at this point, then it is, again, sort of a wavelet analysis. But I think the not requiring that it be centered here, instead requiring that it include there, gives us additional sensitivity.
So it seems to me there's two things that you're doing that seem potentially important. The square versus circle, I doubt that.
Very small, I would agree.
You might expect circle to do epsilon better, but okay. There is this sort of centering arbitrarily, but of course, anytime you do subject clustering of any kind, you're also centering.
Yes.
You're using second derivative information, and you're using effectively a different jet algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
So one hypothesis might be, you're gaining a little bit extra because you're asking, does it look like a W from the point of both Cambridge-Ockham subjects and Cohen subjects? That's somehow more robust. Or you could say, well,
so what is the difference between Cambridge-Ockham jets and cone jets? Because I think Cambridge-Ockham is the one that does not have a KT normalization, right? It is a cone jet. It's just a question of what order I put things in.
So Cambridge-Ockham, you do a sequential clustering just based on the distance measure,
yes.
But it doesn't tend to give you cone-shaped jets. It's anti-KT that gives you cone-shaped jets. The reason being that you have this PT weighting. So, because Cambridge-Ockham, you're just doing with what's closest, and so
mm-hmm.
two soft things could be clustered first, and you end up with weird shapes. Whereas with anti-KT, you have sort of hard thing you start with, and everything that's in a radius gets pulled into it.
Okay. Well, the other thing which might be, which would certainly be more interesting, is if the fact that you're using second derivative information. Whereas somehow mass drop seems like it's more intuitive. I seem maybe like it's more of a first derivative type. More
yes,
analogous
I think so.
To first derivative information.
Maybe you'll talk more about this, but yeah, I was just wondering whether you had some intuitive reason for why it seems to be performing better. Because I'm still sort of stuck on this issue of.
Well, there's a very simple reason of why it should be performing better, which is I now have a two-dimensional parameter space and I have optimized in it. So it will do better.
I'm wondering, let's say I put in a cut on the PT hierarchy of the two subjects. So for instance, let's say I have a hard splitting that gives me the same mass, but for QCD I might expect a softer, wider angle splitting versus W, which gives me something
that's roughly equal.
So I'm
there is a symmetry requirement on the two jets that's also part of this mass drop cut, actually. It has to be sufficiently symmetric in PT. I haven't discussed it, but that is built into this requirement. There's a second parameter there that doesn't do much until you start loosening the mass drop very significantly. When you say, okay, I will accept a mass drop that's only a decrease by 45%, down to 45% of the original mass, then you start becoming fairly sensitive to how symmetric the splittings were, because you would expect QCD would give you something, a decent chunk of the mass and something soft over here.
So usually the standard is, I thought that if you have a new tiger, you go to the good proceedings, and that's what everyone uses to quote their efficiencies. In particular, this sounds very similar to jet substructure without trees.
Substructure without trees.
Where they use the idea of prominence from just something that they borrow from GE.
That's it. That is this the jet profile, where they have said how much has the jet profile changed as I added epsilon. They have a distance measure that they're increasing from the center of the jet, I believe.
I don't think so. They use the angular correlation function. You should look at that.
Angular correlation function.
Yeah.
Meaning in R.
It's. I don't remember the details, but I get they're looking for those
As I recall, they make a plot of the first derivative of something that I thought was equivalent to the jet profile, which is the amount of stuff that I have within a small cone R out of a jet of a big cone R. This is some angular correlation. And they've made a plot of first derivatives and said, where is this highest? And that's what they're interested in. So how much does this overlap with that? I have not explored. This is sort of meant as a proof of principle. There is a technique that uses these things that are well-defined already in image processing. So they've been written out to high computational speed. We could imagine using them. You know, the interesting bit to me, to my mind, is this is, in some sense, much less physics motivated than the other things that we've done. Other people have said, I should get two subjects, they should have much less mass, this makes sense, that's what I think a W should do. Here, our original motivation was, well, there's a tool over there. What happens if I just try to use it and see what happens? It doesn't have any physics in it, it's just a tool, it's good at grayscale images, what can I learn?
That's a weak motivation.
It is a weak motivation, certainly from a physics perspective.
No, also because, like, look, there is a difference in shape, you will find that with a wavelet.
Yeah, the question is, can I apply this tool in a useful and fast way? So if I found that this was completely degenerate with a mass drop cut, which is the first thing we've compared it to, I would say, okay, we don't need this.
Because you demonstrate that, like, what's the qualitative new thing that this is finding with the mass drop cut? Again, if I could do sort of two-variant mass drop, suppose I told you, I haven't done this, so I can't tell you, but suppose I told you that I got comparable improvements by just taking the same jet, bringing it, doing mass drop, and then doing a sort of mass drop prime, where I was just reclustering using a different jet clustering algorithm, and adding together my mass drop with Cambridge Optimum and my mass drop with some other jet algorithm, and suppose that gave you the same improvement. Right?
Then the interesting question is that degenerate or can I improve yet more by doing more things? There is some point at which my analysis reaches a complexity that is not, that the systematics become unbounded.
Right, you don't know what the static
is. Yes.
And you don't know have you tried to see, you said Pythia does well, have you tried to see if there is another code? What does the other code give you? It should probably give you another shape.
Yeah, Herwig or Sherpa or any one of a number of other codes exist.
Even speaking of a program, you have to speak of a tune, right? Because even using people,
right,
if you use a different tune, that you get a different answer.
That's right. I mean, I should say.
The question is sort of what physics is this tool?
Yeah,
but
the
physics
is not physics.
If the physics is hard, then, you know, if it's hard, like wide angle splittings, then it's probably not Monte Carlo dependent. You know, it's really Monte Carlo dependent if you care about, you know,
but
all this
what's
type
the
of
sort
well,
of, what
the
is
Monte
the
Carlos have to model the hard wide
the
angle radiation of QCD. And
sure, but
people,
that's a perturbative.
It's a perturbative thing, but people tell me that the color connection picture, for instance, is missing an important piece, which is when I've built an artificial color connection to a second jet, say. Mm-hmm. Pythia does not know that.
That's
going to
be a small.
I would hope that all of these are side effects.
Let's we'll continue.
Can I ask one more question?
Is it urgent?
Yes. Do you have pictures of events that are rejected by your cut and not, but were not rejected by the mass drop? Mm-hmm. Oh.
I do not have them handy, but I can get some and I'll show them to you tomorrow. They do exist.
Okay.
And you've looked at them.
Yes. I have not looked at them.
I'm not answering questions. Go on.
So this is fairly stable with respect to JetPT, which is a nice feature. It has improved this sensitivity by 6 to 8% over a very wide range of JetPT or WPT. The two being equivalent when I've clustered them into one jet. So I have lots of questions about what can I do with this. You'll recall when we were looking at a W, I said, this one looks like it's transversely polarized. Can I actually systematize that in some way using this tool? I don't know. I would like to, because that would make it more interesting to look at the WW scatterings. I might be able to toss some of the background events to what I'm interested in, which is longitudinal WW scattering. This opening angle, the size at which I see the W, is measuring the PT of the W in a completely independent way from the PT that gets the energy deposited in a calorimeter. Is that a useful thing to know? It probably is. How useful is it to do more sensitive, I don't know, calibrations of the WPT itself? Do I want to require that, say, those two agree before I say, okay, I believe this is an event that I like? The asymmetry in this prong, yes, very good. I already said this one. And this could be generalized, of course, to include more general boosted objects. And I think actually there's an argument to be made that a three-prong event will benefit more from being able to move the origin of the jet than a two-prong does. Because I should be able to now pick up each of the three independently, where before, if I have an origin and I say, okay, they're kind of evenly spread, I might pick up all three at once, and I may not know whether I have two or three prongs here. This was actually a problem for the people Etter was talking about. They had to use some prominence measure and hope the peaks didn't land on top of each other, because if they do, it doesn't look like a top to them. So these boosted bosons, of course, are a powerful probe of new physics, and wavelets can improve our tagging. And it's interesting to think about what exact physics we've discovered inside the boosted bosons that we were missing before. This is independent of the jet algorithm that's used to cluster the thing. It's complementary to these deconstructive techniques where I take my jet apart piece by piece and see what it was made out of. And I would recommend that anyone who is really interested watch for a FastJet plugin to come out that's actually trying to apply these techniques and be usable on data. Thank you.
Disagreement with your independent jet. It might be independent jet algorithm, because the center is determined by the jet algorithm.
That's true. All I'm taking from the jet algorithm is the momentum of the object. That is less sensitive to the algorithm than all of these deconstructive techniques and everything else. But you're right, it's not completely independent.
But also the grooming is dependent on how you cluster your distribution as well.
Yes, you could imagine getting different results from different groomers. One of these has become standard in the substructure techniques.
Which one are you using?
The FastJet plugin that is a jet groomer.
Pruning? I'm guessing it's a modified mass. It's a mass drop cut.
No, it's a separate groomer from the mass drop cut entirely. There is a groomer. And this gets run. I believe it is the jet groomer. I'm trying to remember what the exact call is, but there is one of these things exists as an independent FastJet plugin, and that is the one. And this gets run by every experimental collaboration before they do anything else.
So have you guys looked at the three-pronged events where you're comparing this to, say, a top cabin?
We have looked at three-pronged events, but we haven't yet tried to understand how we would go about tagging them, as distinct from two-prong events. So I don't have any interesting results for you there yet. We're very interested in moving in that direction.
Any more questions?
Oh, I see. Okay, because one would expect to have some change going to very, very, very high PT.
I would expect if I get out to very high PTs that I'm going to start getting resolution effects from a detector. For sure. And if I go to very low PTs, I'm not going to cluster this into a jet anymore. So that's actually decided where we have cut this plot.
Right.
As we said, okay, beyond here, I don't really believe my resolution anymore.
Yeah, the numbers, so I was wondering how was that range of PTs. Okay.
And you're using FastJet to do this?
To do what?
To do your mock-up detector sim?
So that bit was coded by my collaborator, but at one point I had written an algorithm that just lived in root that took all the particles that were visible and said, you are in this bin and you are in this bin and so forth.
Okay.
I don't know if that's what we're doing or not.
Well, I mean, they're doing smeared the jet.
Right.
No, we haven't explicitly smeared the jet before we did this. That's right. You could imagine applying an error to each particle's PT from a tracker, say, which is the best approximation to what we're going to get here, and then some other spreading across multiple of our pseudocalorimeter cells of neutrals. This should not destroy the overall features in these pictures.
This comment is just echoing what I said. I think the fundamental problem I have with this is that if you told me you take a Fourier transform of something and it works, I would say it probably worked because you took a phenomenon which was delocalized in time, its power was delocalized, and you transformed it into a space where all the power was localized, with namely frequency space,
mm-hmm.
right, as you saw as Sharpie. And that's why it worked, it was much easier to see it. It's not clear here what the wave that really buys you, what is that thing that it packages nicely, is it?
So this actually, we explored the subtractive wavelets, those that have a mother wavelet in them. These edge detecting frequency having wavelets. But the father wavelet is basically just an averaging. As you said, it's just a square cone jet.
No, I'm not suggesting you use a Fourier wavelet, but saying when you do a transform, when there is an improvement, there is often a strong physical reason why there was an improvement. And it's not quite clear why.
I think it's the ability to look at sections of the jet that are in particular directions from the center. That's the fundamentally new and interesting thing here, is that we have allowed our wavelet to stretch in a given direction as far as it wants to collect all the energy. We aren't bound to the jet axis in the way that many other algorithms are. We don't totally ignore the jet axis, because that would be quite silly.
Any way that reclustering is pretty much independent of it too, right?
If I recluster and I got a very different jet axis, for instance, I would get a different answer here, yeah.
No, what I'm saying is techniques that rely on reclustering are also, at those earlier stages, letting the reclustering happen independently wherever the energy is. So the wavelet doesn't seem to be doing anything fundamentally different from that.
Like, for instance, there's a thing called telescoping jets, which is sort of a form of Q-jets, where you basically take the jet and you recluster it, you know, with point one, point two, point three. And when you compare the, say, mass or whatever that you get from the different size jets, you can look for features that appear at a particular size. So it would be interesting to know if your technique does something that that's not latching onto, and then sort of what that is.
Yeah,
and I would very much like to compare this to a lot of different techniques that I haven't gotten the opportunity to do yet.
I mean, so what you say, I mean, I agree that you know, it's good to have a technique that follows the energy rather than being locked to the center of the jet too tightly. But it seems to me most of the tigers that I've seen do that in one form or another. So that's not the difference. The second derivative thing seems different. The fact that you're asking questions about sort of the physics about the energy at different scales rather than the distribution of energy seems somehow,
but
it's somehow maybe
but the bottom line is I don't even understand how this even makes a difference, right? If you say no, get 6% improvement in something that you don't know what the systematics are.
No, but come
it's
on.
Not
give, the, give the guy a break. I mean, often the data did support the conclusions from Monte Carlo, so there is reason to be optimistic. I mean, he'll spend a few years now trying to convince people to actually look at his data, and that's fine. But
and I mean, I think the other thing is to, of course, see if, I mean, this is not the first thing you tried, but it's the sort of the first step of this promise of this direction, right? So it's very possible that a sort of by understanding the physics of it more and refining it, you could get better than 7%.
Yeah, I really think of this as just a proof of principle.
Yeah.
That there is an algorithm that uses this technique that can improve things. And I don't, it's certainly not an upper bound on how much it can improve.
So given that you've seen how your data reject the data points, look, can you draw a picture of what is different between the data that this thing, how the 7%, the data that causes the 7% improvement looks like? different from what was done before?
It'll be much better if I get a few pictures from my collaborator who has them on his computer. But I will ask him for them, and hopefully I'll have them by tomorrow.
Right. Okay.